Welcome to the B-Side, podcast number 14 of Tawasin Lights Church. This is January 27th, 2014. My name is Rhoda Brooks, and with me today is Pastor Steve Croker, our lead pastor.
Hey.
And Pastor Tyler Crawford, our youth pastor.
What's up?
There you go. Got a new greeting this week. So, welcome to the B-Side. I am so excited today. We actually had so many questions sent to us, we can't even do them all today. So if you're listening and you sent us a question, we love that. And if we don't answer today, it's not because we didn't love that. It's that we just really can't do them all today. So hold on, come back next week, and we're going to plow our way through them. But this is really, really great. But you know what? I just have to, okay, before we started recording, the three of us were sitting here talking about adoption, people we know who have adopted, and just like the processes of that. But on Saturday, after our little Cambodian Billets, who those of us who got to spend time with us this week, our friends from Place of Rescue, were here, we said goodbye to them. And then the two girls on our Cambodia team who are my discipleship partners, they're both they're grade 9 and 10. We headed down to Missions Fest. And I haven't been to Missions Fest in years, I must confess. But they have this new film festival that they introduced like 4 or 5 years ago. And I had looked at the different films that they'd be showing. And we went to the screening of The Dropbox. And The Dropbox is basically a documentary about this Korean pastor who he and his wife have basically created this box outside their church or their home slash church. And it has a sensor in it. And so when people are going to abandon their babies, they'll put them in the Dropbox. And then a sensor goes off, and they go down and get the baby. And then the reason they did this is, I guess, that in Korea, there's this huge issue of baby abandonment. Like, it's actually massive. But because there's such it's such a culture where that would be really still shameful to do, and so it's not really, it wasn't really addressed or talked about a lot, but it was pretty rampant. So he had, because he was a pastor, he'd had babies left and dropped off to him before, and then in the first handful of kids, I guess, one of them had been dropped off outside and it had been freezing cold, and if he hadn't found her in time, then she would have perished because of the cold, which led him to build this box. And he has since, they have now adopted, they have 14 children, and I think only one is theirs, like biologically, and almost all the children he has, if not all of them, no, two are biologically his, but most of them are quite moderately to severely disabled in some way, and meanwhile, he's still collected more than 300 babies through this box. Wow. That he can't keep them all, right? So anyway, there had been this, so that is a big story in itself. It's supposed to be released, like it was like an unedited version of the film. Oh, well, it was edited, but it wasn't finished. We got a preview version of it to see. But it's supposed to be getting finished up in the next 2 weeks for release. And so if you hear about it, The Dropbox is really inspirational.
That
story.
It was on Facebook. There was like a thing going around promo a couple weeks ago.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Someone
like
else
a little,
about it.
Maybe
clip
like
about
a
it?
4 minute clip that was to just yeah, said, I like, this that, box. When you see the reason for this box, you'll.
I remember hearing about
this
actually
or something.
Like a couple years ago.
Yeah, so because what happened was.
It got so popular, they made a whole film about it or something?
Yeah, well, what happened was, well, now, which I didn't know, there's a Dropbox at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. Outside the ER. It's called the Angel's Cradle. You can Google it up. So it's Angel's Cradle, but there's now Dropboxes all over the world. They're in Germany, and stuff. Like there's Dropboxes all over the place. But I don't know if he's like the actual originator of this or not. But what I found cool is inspirational story, hands down, about this pastor, so it's worth seeing. What I don't know if you'll see when it comes out is because we were at the screening at Missions Fest, it's not uncommon for a director of a movie to come up at the beginning and talk about his movie a bit, but the guy who directed it couldn't be there, so he sent kind of like a video message for everybody in the audience. And so he pops up on the screen, and I mean, the guy looks young, right? He looks like you without your beard on. Like, this guy looks really young.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, this guy is directing this. He's in California. The coolest thing was this. So he and some others had seen an article about this guy a couple of years ago, had gone to Korea to make a film, And in his mentality was like, yeah, we're going to go to Korea and we're going to help save babies by making this film and bringing attention to this. And then he says, it wasn't about that at all. He's like, it was about God saving me. He goes, I came to Christ through doing this documentary.
Huh.
Like, he wasn't a Christian, and he went out to do this documentary about this pastor and what he's doing with his life and being obedient to God and this thing he's called. And just through his interaction with this pastor has come to Christ, and he's sharing this. And, I mean, the guy's like, I just realized my own deformities, my own needs for him, my own, like, how sin has twisted things in my life and my need to be adopted by the Father. And, like, and he goes, so this movie is not about babies. It's not about this hero of a man. It is about God's love for us. And he just, but to me, that was so cool. And it was really, I think, I shared it with our Cambodia team who met on Sunday, because I'm like, you know, we always think of event, like, it's not bad to think of how you will evangelize or how you will share Jesus with people. But here's this pastor who is sharing Jesus with, in his situation of adopting all these babies. And but then God calls this documentary maker from California, mm-hmm. who comes out just to meet this man and see his life and the testimony of his life. And through that, God uses that to call him to himself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it was really cool. So I don't know if I was more excited about the movie or the director's little blurb at the beginning. Yeah. It was really,
this is really kind of cool. I mean, this is the story of Christian faith in some ways, because there's paintings that go, all drawings that go all the way back to the first or second century of Christians pulling babies out of the Tiber River that had been thrown in by Romans. I mean, this is
the story of Moses.
Yeah,
right. Like,
this goes back to at the heart of what Christianity is about. Is so in every century, there's been cases like things like this. This is what we've always been about, is rescuing the unloved. And that was one of the things in the first century that made Christianity so remarkable. And they were welcoming and adopting Roman babies and loving them as their own because the Romans didn't want them, and rescuing them out of garbage piles and out of the river.
Well, and this man, like, he was an incredible man, and his wife. They had a daughter, and then they had a son who's now, in this documentary, he's 26. But their son was severely disabled. Like, he didn't come out of the hospital for years. Hmm. And he cannot sit up on his own, and he can't do anything for himself. And, like, he's a grown man now, right? And he needs help breathing and things like that, too. But so they already have the son who requires so much physical care. And then they've still adopted, like, some of the kids have cerebral palsy or Down syndrome in varying degrees, right? And some children only have, like, physical challenges but not mental challenges. But and they do have people around them. They do have other believers around them that support them in their work. But they just share their story. It's really incredible. You know, like, at one point, he's talking about when his son was born, and he's like, why God? Why did this have to happen to our son? But it also was part of how their ministry started, you know, and his heart for others, and him just being like he would die for these children, and he sees value in every single one of them, and who they are individually. Mm-hmm. And, it's really, really incredible story.
Well, I often think adoption is probably the closest parallel that we as humans have to understanding how God relates to us, in the sense of, like, you know, I think about it in the terms of you know, I have family members who've adopted, and here's children that have literally no rights to your family, right? Like, they have no natural rights, but by the willful choice of loving parents, they're brought in and not treated as friends, but actually given
full rights
as family. So, like, you know, I have a niece and a nephew that have no natural rights to be called Crawfords and to be loved and blessed by our extended family, but more specifically, like, my brother and his wife. But then all of a sudden, they're there. Yeah. They are. Like, they're my parents' grandkids. They're my niece and nephew, and we love them just the same. And I think it's a small glimmer of what Christ has done in adoption to us. Like, that's why I love that parallel. And I was trying to impress Steve too by saying it.
Were you?
Yeah, a little bit. I could see that it was working.
We're going to talk about the chocolate bribes that Steve put on the table for us before this podcast.
This podcast brought to you by Smarties.
And the giant box for Smarties. Yeah. Now in 3-pound boxes.
Yeah.
That was my stocking stuffer.
Aww. Oh, so nice of you to share it with us.
Not only is it chocolate, it's old chocolate.
Sitting in my desk for weeks.
Anyway, so if you get a chance to see it, anyway, it was good. No, it was really good. Okay, so I was sitting in a sermon yesterday. I enjoyed it because I got to sit in the whole sermon. That was great. And, so now we're on the topic of, like, adoption, children, things around the world. And, you know, when you're talking in the passage about, basically, you mentioned the fact that especially in North American society, we feel like we've evolved and we don't need certain things. But we're actually, as globally, we're the bloodiest century that has been. And that we don't have the corner.
On depravity.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And depravity. And I think it was that night I watched The Passionate Eye had a documentary on children on basically the war front. I can't remember, on the border. Like, and it was this family in Syria who, the children of this one man who was leading rebel forces. And it basically was interviewing the kids, like, and they just reminded me of the kids. I mean, obviously, they're Syrian and not Cambodian, but just the same, like, kids, you know. And there's this 5-year-old, and they're like, so what do you like to do? She goes, well, we used to walk for ice cream, and we used to get this, but now we don't think about going anywhere like that. So what do you like to do? Well, my favorite thing to do is spend time with my dad and make bombs. And I collect the shrapnel and the ribbon. Like, this is, like, current, right? And there's this cutest little fight, and she's just talking, and you watch the kids and how they relate, and I'm like, these are children now. These are children living. We can't even comprehend this, you know? So it just made me think of your comment in the Romans thing of, like, that, yeah, we don't have the corner. Yeah. Anyway.
You know, Sunday's message, I remember I was talking to Paul about it this morning, and he asked me, you know, how did it go? How did I feel when? And I was like, well, you know, I thought it was awful. Like, I was...
You always think... The ones I love, you always think were awful.
I did not feel well. I was heavily medicated.
The truth comes out.
And no, I didn't sleep well. I wasn't able to concentrate. I just thought it was a very poor job. I wasn't as well prepared as it liked. So I felt like I hadn't done well. And he was shocked because he said he had 3 conversations with people after church who... Separately... 2 of which were, you know, were in tears and just moved by what God had said to them through the message, and these are the steps they're going to take. I was just really encouraged because it wasn't because of great oratory skill or preparation. Like, I thought, I felt bad that I let everyone down almost, you know, but that's just God's word, you know. Yeah. As soon as we think that it's based on really skillful preparation and convincing people of things, or as soon as we trust in kind of our own gifting to accomplish this. I mean, God's going to build his church, and his word's going to go forth. He doesn't need me. And as long as we're faithful to his word, mm-hmm. whether it's in power or in weakness, God's going to do his work. So, I mean, it was just really cool to see that here, like, it wasn't me, because I...
Well, and that's the...
It was God. God and his word did his work, and I happened to be on stage mumbling about when he was doing it.
That's what I love about his word, you know? That it's living, that it's a living word, right? That the Spirit uses the word in tandem, and God uses it to move people's hearts and convict them of things or spur them on to things.
And we go through books of the Bible. Like, I would never pick, just for, you know, here you go, 1 week, pick a passage, speak on whatever you want. I would never pick Romans chapter 2. Why would I do that? Why would anyone pick, like, hey, let's pick the passage where God judges everyone and people are going to go to hell? Like, nobody would want to do that. Nobody would want to come hear that. Like,
and if they did want to do that, I'd be a little bit worried about their motives for advancing the gospel.
Yeah. So, but it's God's word, and we go through it believing that he's put it there for us, and believing that if we go through passage, like, one passage at a time, we'll preach the full counsel of God in time, and we won't filter and distort his word through our motives, right? And you end up talking about things you would never choose. And yet, even on those Sundays when you're like, I would never pick this, but this is what it says, God works in significant way through the very words I would not pick to build his kingdom and do his thing. And you go, that's why we preach God's word and mm-hmm. not just pick randomly my favorite verse. Like, just do a sermon series on my
verses.
Favorite verses and my favorite stories. People don't need to hear my favorite stories. They need to hear the full counsel of God, which very much includes Romans chapter 2, though I wouldn't pick it. I only picked it because it was after Romans 1, and people are smart enough to do math and go, hey, you skipped that.
Yeah. I still remember at a conference, you and I were both at, John Neufeld talking, who's the pastor at Burnaby, and William giving this example of the burden of preaching expositional sermons. And I can't remember exactly the passage, but it was some passage on...
You're thinking of like Romans 11 on the role of Jews, and you think of that story?
I heard think
story.
So, yeah, where he talked the story about essentially it was something fellow, about like the root, and then out of it, it spoke to this Jewish guy with a Jewish heritage sitting.
Came for the first time.
Yeah.
And it
I'll let you finish the story because I can just remember like.
I remember the guy. I know the guy personally. I met him. Pastor John Neufeld, he's preaching through Romans, and he gets to Romans 11, and it's all about the role of Israel. And in the tree of God, and they're getting lobbed off and welded back on and grafted back on. That weld, you don't weld trees, you graft.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
and he's kind of going like, "What? You know, I would never pick this, but this is the passage, right?" And it happens that morning. Happens in God's divine sovereignty. There's a fellow who stumbled into church for the first time in life, who is Jewish, kind of culturally, not religiously, and. Heard the gospel through that message and was deeply convicted and through that realizing that even me, like the gospel's even for me, a Jewish man, he gets saved and changes his life and changes his family and
yeah, I'll never forget that. I didn't remember all the details of the passage. For some reason I thought it was an Old Testament passage. But it's just a neat story about how like
preach the word.
Well, and we often think we let, especially as men, like we let, I'm sure it's effective all of us, but we let pride rule us so often and think that like I'm great, right? And then it's often in like the points where we are just, you know, we hit a home run and nothing happens, you know, and then we lay down a bunt or whatever it is, or you
revival
know, or strike out in our minds,
yeah,
like waste our time. And God just comes up and is just like, no, I'm going to turn this garbage into like sweet incense and do my work. Just to show you how useless you could be. Like how little I need you, but how much I want you. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I have another question out of Sunday sermon.
Okay.
Because it was talking about, you know, like you talked about in the first, the chapter the week before, talking about judgment of those that are irreligious. And then this week was really convicting those who were religious about who they were judging and to really look at themselves. Yep. But so I just was wondering, how do we take that? Because I heard what you were saying. I heard about the need to examine our own hearts. But then how does that relate in our role as Christians for seeking justice for people? So like taking Cambodia with child prostitution or things like that. Like, how do we not judge others, but at the same time seek justice for... Like, what's the balance between those two concepts for us as Christians as we live out our lives with the gospel? Or did I spring that one on you too?
Oh, you did spring it on me. the big problem in the passage is that these people, the critical moralizers, whatever you want to call them, chapter 2, they... judge others and do the very same things. That's the whole problem, is that they're looking at the guys in chapter 1 and saying, oh, look at these horrible sinners, but they don't recognize it in themselves. So Paul's big point is that there's a group of people who think, yeah, there's a lot of problem with sin in the world, but not me, right? And he goes, look, you're judging everyone else. You're criticizing and pointing out the problems with everyone else, but you don't see that it's in you as well. And his goal is to show in chapter, at the end of chapter 1, chapter 2, and beginning of chapter 3, his goal is to show everyone who's reading, listening to the letter, that they have a big problem. They need God's righteousness. On their own, they are found lacking. And so some people are going to need to be shown because they're just unending immorality, and they have just no conscience. Like, they have no they're not ashamed of what they do. They just live a lifestyle, and they need to be told, this is wrong, and what you're doing is wrong. Other people have a sense that they're better than others. Like, the problem with it in the world is everyone else. They kind of have a view of their own. Like, they're moral, and everyone else is the problem.
Well, they need to be shown. That at all anymore.
No. But they need to be shown that this extends to you as well. And then for this week's message is looking at the Jews at the end of chapter 2 who keep the law, but he goes, hey, the issue is a heart issue. Even if you do keep the law, you're not obeying it in your heart, and your heart is still broken. Problem, right? Okay, so how do your question was, how do we
I think I get what you're saying, because my thing was like, how do you not judge people and still seek justice that doesn't feel like it's making a judgment statement on people, right? But I see your point in that you don't want to run around judging and seeking justice without having your own heart right before God and your motives. Because I think of this pastor, right? And he's obviously dealing and helping with people that a lot of people in their society would judge. And yet his response to it is not to, like, whenever he received a baby, he's always praying, like, his first prayer is that no babies would come. You know, like, he's always praying, like, that he would get no babies, and that parents would be, like, that it wouldn't be the situation. But if they are to be vetted, or people do need help, that they would come safely, you know? So he's not working out of a place of self-righteousness.
Yeah, that's the big issue. That was, like, even Jesus' parable of the log and the speck, or his problem with the Pharisees, or all these passages. The New Testament's not against making judgments, evaluations, right? It's against a judgmental attitude that judges others and ignores self. That's always the issue, right? It's about, and in this passage, they criticize others and ignore their self. It's not saying you should never criticize others, but we should criticize ourselves. We should examine our own heart. So in Jesus' parable, right, the log and the speck, it says, remove the log, and then you will be able to help your brother with the speck. You are, like, he wasn't wrong to try and remove the speck in the brother's eye. There was a problem in this other person's life, and you are responsible, as Christians, we're responsible for each other to help each other with the stuff in our life that we can't see. But the problem was, he had a way bigger thing in his own eye that he was ignoring. So he's supposed to deal with his own broken heart, his own sin, his own corruption, get help with that. And once you have this attitude of repentance, humility, confession, working on our, you know, sanctification, working on our own heart, then he's in the position to actually help others. So I think the answer for the Christian is that we ought to be more critical of our own heart than others, but we still have a responsibility for others. And so there's this a humility and repentance, a self-examination that has to be step one. And if that's in place, then we do have a responsibility to help each other out if we see sin in each other's lives. But it doesn't come out of a judgmental, critical spirit, but an attitude of love, of wanting to restore, help, you know?
Well, and I think we've both in the church and outside of the walls of the church, have taken that... haven't taken that approach that you just described, and that in fact we've often used judgment as a cloak for doing whatever we want.
Yes.
And not being able, so, you know, if I'm out neglecting my wife every night of the week and drinking or something, and Steve comes up to me as my friend and says, hey, like, cut it out, like, pay attention to your family, and the natural response often is, who are you to judge? Stop judging me. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes accusatory. It's almost like we use judgment in the same way we use tolerance now, that, like, it's something that you shouldn't do. Like, you shouldn't...
Ever.
Ever. You shouldn't judge someone. You shouldn't tell someone how to live their life. Well, no, that's pretty contrary to the narrative written in Scripture that God has a plan for our lives, and that as Christians we're called to support and judge and condemn... when necessary, one another, and build up, right? Like, you know, like the law and the prophets, Jesus said, hang on the balance of love God, love others. Part of loving others is telling them when they're being idiots. Mm-hmm. Or, you know.
But if you think about it, like, if you actually understand grace for yourself, if you've understood the grace of God in your own life and have been broken before Him, how that communicates across will look very,
very
differently.
Yes.
So, like, if you, like, and that's why if people know that someone has walked in their shoes, they will take correction from someone speaking in love and empathy and being like, you need to stop this, and I know you need to stop, and let me tell you about God. Like, it's very different than saying, you're a horrible person, you really need to stop that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so it actually changes the whole process by going.
Yeah, I would agree on some hands, but on the other hand, I go, we like to hide behind delivery a lot too, where sometimes the truth isn't delivered cleanly or nicely, but it can still be done in love.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is if you haven't actually had that motive that we're going back
right
to your heart,
sure, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you haven't had your heart broken and received the grace, you cannot bestow grace if you don't understand grace for yourself.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, like,
you can bestow truth, but it might not mean a thing if you can't bestow it with grace. Right.
So, like,
because you don't comprehend it.
You can criticize in a way that makes you feel better because you're like, hey, look at all those other guys. Look at you. Look at the problems everyone. And it's a way of protecting yourself from repenting. I don't have to deal with my stuff if I point out everyone else's sin.
Right.
Totally evil, right? And this is like religious sin. But then, and then there's like the Galatians 6, which is, you know, is restore one another. It talks about love. It talks about with gentleness. And the goal is restoration. Or 1 Corinthians 5, where we are to judge others in the church because we're looking out for each other and we're protecting each other. And it's those outside the church we're not to judge. And so that's God's job. God judges. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Tyler. The whole New Testament requires that we are judging in a certain sense. But I think what it'd be, judge is probably a loaded term. It's probably not the helpful term because we think of judge as judgmental, critical, harsh, a sense of moral superiority, which is not what we're after. But we do have a responsibility for the growth of each other in the church.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to keep moving on because we did get a few questions that were sent in together and are tied together, and I want to make sure we have time for them today. So I'm going to make sure we move along, but I also want to make sure that we touch base on them. So the questions came from a community group, and the question is, what happens to someone who dies but wasn't old enough or otherwise wasn't capable of understanding about Jesus and salvation? For example, young children, children who die before birth, people with dementia or other mental illness or intellectual challenges. Does it matter if the person was brought up in a Christian or non-Christian home? That's the first question.
Okay. It's a great question, and one I probably can't definitively solve, but we can take a crack at it because I think it's important how we think about this issue, not just, you know, like, it's very simple to go, oh yeah, all kids go to heaven, which is probably what most everyone's going to say, but I want to actually be biblical in this and actually think rightly about it and not just jump there without thought.
You know what, and before you answer that, I'm going to group the second question in with it.
Okay.
So is there an age of accountability? So the first one was basically what if they die or they weren't old enough or not capable. So the second one's kind of just grouped in with that because it says, is there an age of accountability before which children who die are treated with mercy of God as the blood of Christ is applied? So we'd see them in heaven even if they never understood about the salvation. So we're talking about people who we think haven't understood the gospel of Jesus for whatever
namely,
reason.
Namely, the best example is infants.
Yeah.
Newborn. Yeah. So there's really three options, right? The first would be that all infants and those who also have maybe mental are incapable of understanding. All infants go to heaven. Mm-hmm. Option two is some go and some don't based on some factor. Mm-hmm. Three would be because they're all born with the sin nature, they all go to hell. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are the only options. I don't know anyone who actually claims number three. You could kind of make a case for it, but I wouldn't. Because what you would say is because they have a sin nature, right? But that seems extremely harsh and counter to some of the other things we'll look at. So the question is, do all automatically as infants go to heaven, or is there some condition or some situation that some do and some don't, right? Mm-hmm. And does the Bible point to anything, right? And the problem is we don't have one specific, like I don't have a text that says definitively, but we have a lot of things we could look at. Now, the Catholic Church historically would say that all babies are born with a sin. Everyone has a sin nature. We've inherited from Adam. And so a baby would be born sinful. But through baptism, your sin nature is washed away, your inherited sin. So if a baby, that's why you baptize a baby, is then they're saved, because the baptism actually accomplishes that salvation. And so if it's a baptized baby, they'll go to heaven. Otherwise, maybe not. I'm going to disagree with that, obviously, right?
Because I don't. That sounds pretty. No,
that's kind of. So that's one way. Now, that's how they have dealt with that. But I think that's a bad understanding of baptism. That's an unbiblical understanding of baptism and an unbiblical understanding of how inherited sin works. Yeah. So trying to get their head around this is where people have come up with the idea of the age of accountability, which is not...
I've never even heard of that before.
Oh, really?
No.
It's often...
Because, like, every kid is different... Every kid is different. So people, how do you have, like, a standard age of accountability?
I don't know that there would be a standard age of accountability, but it would be more of a developmental stage of accountability.
So people, some people have looked at, like, 12 years old because of the ties with kind of Jewish thought around puberty, entering adulthood. Yeah. So under 12 or under whatever age, you're not accountable. And then over that age, you are. So if someone dies before they reach the mysterious age of accountability, it's not held against them. I actually don't think this is accurate, because a few things. One is it's just not – doesn't fit with how people grow. There's not like all of a sudden there's a light switch day. I'm not accountable, then I am. I don't have enough knowledge to make good decisions, and then all of a sudden you do. Mm-hmm. I don't think that fits with
like a magic
birthday. Yeah, like all of a sudden there's a magic birthday. Yesterday you didn't have enough knowledge to be responsible for your decisions, but today you are. Now, as we grow in
drinking
knowledge...
Drinking age and driving age with those ideas then, right? Like, it's true. It's
well, that's how a government sense. Works, but it doesn't, it's not how, it's not how God works.
No, but it's true. I'm in agreement with you.
Open up the box. You can have more.
I'm going in for Smarty. This is really stressful.
Smarty break. So, you can't make a... I don't think you can make a biblical case for it. I think it helps kind of philosophically because what you're saying is some kids don't know enough to be held responsible for their decisions. But I think reality is that we grow in our understanding and awareness and responsibility gradually. It's not like a light switch flipping on from zero to whatever, right?
Yeah.
But I think the question then is, does an infant know enough to be held responsible for their sin or for their situation, right? This is where I think our passage from a couple weeks ago, like Romans 1, said, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they're without excuse. So people who don't have God's special revelation are still held responsible for their sinful choices because God has made himself known in creation. So a question I'd ask is that true of an infant?
Because are they actually aware of creation or not?
Has God revealed enough to an infant that they are without excuse?
I would say no.
So some people would look at that passage and say, the reason why those who don't have God's word don't have an excuse is because God has made himself known to them through reason, through the beauty of creation, through writing his law in their hearts, through their conscience, through these things, right? So you could, I think... You make a good case that an infant does not yet have that opened up to them. Now, I think it would be wrong reasoning to say, well, children are innocent, therefore. Well, no, we're told that,
that we're born,
with a sin nature. So in one sense, we have to say that we are born as sinners from our mother's womb, Psalm 51:5. But we also would say that Psalm 139, he knows us in our mother's womb. He knits us together. He's involved intimately with us. He cares about us from infancy. We also have to look at God's character and God welcoming, Jesus welcoming the children. prioritizing, emphasizing, you know, we must become like children.
And he actually says that the kingdom belongs to them, right? In Matthew 19. So, yeah, it's...
And then I think you go to, in 2 Samuel 12, people often go here, 2 Samuel 12, 23, it's David, and his son, his child dies. The baby child dies. And he says that...
what verse was that?
Verse 23. Do you have it there?
I'm trying to get it. My phone is acting slowly.
Second Samuel 12. So people often look at this. This is after his the whole Bathsheba incident. And he says, when his mourning is done, David says, "Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." And you want to be careful about reading too much into that one sentence, but David is suggesting that he can't bring the baby back. The baby's dead. There's no point in mourning any longer. He can't come back to me, but I will go to him. I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. Suggesting that his newborn baby that died is in a place where he will go. And that's really all we're told. But it's a case study of a child that died, a baby that died, who has gone to be... And we would say that, well, where's David going? Mm-hmm. Well, David's a believer. David's going to be in heaven. David's going to be with God in paradise. So kind of... It's a bit of a slight stretch, right?
Because that would go to the point of the question of, does it make a difference that they were born in a Christian home or not? I don't think it would.
Because
there's lots of people who God draws to himself that aren't from Christian homes.
Yeah. So I think if you look at the David case, you can make, combined with all these things and God's heart for children, we know that God will be absolutely just and fair, right? Every mouth will be stopped. And like the passage we read on this Sunday, like, no one's going to complain in the end. It'll be obvious to everyone that God has made the right decision. And so I would make the case that because of the nature of who God is, and because of the not their purity and innocence, because all children are born good, designed good, but broken and tainted by sin, but because of they have not been made aware, they have not had opportunity to perceive God even in creation, that an infant would go to heaven, would be forgiven by God because of Christ's death in their place.
But then as for like what is the age that happens or people with mental challenges and all that, I think for me that only God knows each of our hearts. Only God knows what he's written on our hearts and what he's provided for understanding. Only God knows who he calls to himself. You know, like there's some things where we want to have secure, fixed answers on a lot of these things because that's what we're comfortable with. But they're not our things to understand
or
control. You know, like...
I have a way easier time with infants than when we start talking about children, because you go a child that's 2, 3. Now, it's a different case to say they had no opportunity. They couldn't, you know anything. In the end, I don't know. I don't know their heart, but I think, okay, one of the problems is I think what people sometimes do is they go, oh, they must all go to heaven because they're innocent children. Mm-hmm. If they do, that's not the reason. I would say they go to heaven because of God's mercy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily what they deserve because they had a sin nature, though they haven't made choices yet. They haven't been, maybe if they're an unborn child or barely, you know, only alive for 8 hours. We all know these situations. I've done funerals for children like this. It's because of the incredible mercy of God who's rescuing the children that he loves and calling them to himself. We have to look at God's character more than the choices of the baby.
Right, sense? And that's what I wanted to add, actually, before Rhoda just interrupted me. was that so often, so often we want to know the answers. Like we kind of want to know the mind of God, and I think that's a godly characteristic sometimes, that we want to know the mind and heart of God. However, I think there's some things that we actually just have to trust to his nature. that we have to trust into the nature of God, that we know these things about God, that he is good, that he is loving, that he is just, that he is benevolent. Like, and so, you know, and trust that whatever happens with a four-year-old child or a, you know, a unborn child, that it's good. Mm-hmm. Like, it is good. Because God will...
And it will glorify control, his name.
And it will glorify his name. Yeah. So at the end of the day, like, I always wonder with these questions for us, like, mm-hmm. they're good to know, but they really challenge us to, do we trust the character and nature of who God is?
Yeah.
Because, like, it's big picture stuff. And I'm one of those guys that likes to pull the lens back and says, if God looks like this, then we actually have to really just surrender that to him, to recognize that...
Yeah.
We don't know definitively. I think we can make reasonable arguments, which you've done, and I think we can rest in, and there's enough reasonability in Scripture to say, like, we can rest in that. But more than anything, I think we can say, like,
yeah,
I can trust that God's good, and what he will do, whatever ends up happening, is right.
And I think that honors him. Like, what makes me a little bit, not cringe, but is when some people approach the question almost with a level of certainty. And it's based on a view of humanity. Like, it's like, I know God will bring them all to heaven because they're innocent little kids. I think a better approach is to go, I have great hope that God will bring all unborn or newborn or infants that die tragically to himself, because it's part of his will, because he is a merciful and gracious father who knows and will do what is just and right. And we humbly trust him with hope into the arms of a loving and gracious father, rather than kind of confident assertions because of the goodness of babies.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's ironic, right? Is that if godly, gospel-loving, Jesus-following Christian people will rationalize that way for infants, they're good children, but when they're sharing the gospel with their friends, will speak of their own brokenness and depravity and how there's such a necessity for the grace of God. Yeah. And that's what I think is so funny, because at the end of the day, we're born with a sin nature, so we recognize our own brokenness from the womb.
Yeah.
Have you met 2-year-olds? Like,
they are terrible.
That's what they call them, the terrible twos. Yeah. Like, you love them, but they're two.
One other thing is, which has helped me because of a larger theological thing, which maybe some people might find cheeky here, but I think this is a lot less of a problem for someone who holds to a Reformed view of election, is what I mean.
Okay, but we can't. I've totally been thinking like is election, what I mean. Predestination, yeah. Conversation is, but okay. I don't want to go there today because we're actually out of time.
Oh, no, we have to.
No, like, you're out of time.
If you hold to a more Arminian view of election and free will, where God has done all he can to save people, mm-hmm. and they now need to make the choice to accept or reject.
It's up to us.
You have a child who isn't old enough to accept or reject, which means by default they've rejected because they haven't accepted. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of put you in a troubling bind of maybe does God override their will, mm-hmm. to save them, contrary to what he does in other places.
What about free will?
But if you hold to a more Reformed, Calvinistic view of election, as I would, we would say that ultimately God chooses in his mercy to save people. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And so I have no problems. I have zero theological problems with God in his mercy intervening and saving a 8-hour-old baby who has not yet old enough to choose. God can save, and that perfectly fits with a Calvinistic view of God, that God will
calls people to himself
even before they call him back. Mm-hmm. So he is more than capable and able, and it fits perfectly with his gracious character to call people to himself, even if they don't understand it yet. Mm-hmm. Versus that's more of a struggle if you hold to a more Arminian view of election and free will, because of your elevation of the choice. That first we choose. So it's going to be a lot more struggle if you hold to an Arminian view. If you hold a more Calvinistic view, it's actually not that big of a deal. It fits well with the merciful calling of God. So,
well, I am actually glad you brought it up, because I was thinking about that a lot when you were giving your whole answers, and I didn't. I was like, well, oh, I still want to interject a question about predestination in here, but I don't know if I should. So,
what about our
choice? This is a good thing that if you are listening today, and now Steve has brought up this topic, and there was actually a couple more questions, but we're going to save them for another week.
Okay.
But if you have a question about that, then this is a perfect opportunity for you to send more questions to us at the B-side. At TwasonAlliance.org, and we can delve into it some more with you. We would look forward to that. Thanks for joining us today. See you later.
Toodaloo.